Tonight, we're going to study about a guy named Solomon, a half-hearted king. The passages we'll be working from will be found in 1 Kings chapters 3 through 11. And don't worry, we're not going to read the whole thing. But before I get started, maybe I should tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Scott Risley, and I am a college student down on campus. I work with the college ministry down there. And I spend a lot of time working with college students. I live with college students. I am a college student. So, and one thing that, a question that a lot of us think about is, where is my life going to go? You know, we're sitting here, we're relatively uncommitted to much. You know, we're still kind of bouncing around in school, switching from major to major. And we've got our whole lives ahead of us. And many of us, we're pretty excited about the things of God, many of my friends. And we wonder, are we still going to be excited about those things in 10, 20, 30 years? You know, yeah, we're excited now, but, you know, when we're old and gray, when we're past our prime, when we're looking back at our lives, you know, when I'm 40 years old, what am I going to look back and see that I've done? And, you know, I might think, well, you know, I'm excited about this stuff now, so I'm going to be excited then. But the reality of the situation is that is not often the case. Studies have shown that most people, even if they start out very excited about spiritual things, the majority of them actually fade away. A guy named Bobby Clinton did a study of 900 Christian leaders, great men and women of God. It's some from the Bible all the way up till modern times. And what he found is that 2 out of 3 ended up compromised. Only 1 in 3 could look back at their lives and say, yeah, I'm happy with how things turned out there. And tonight we're going to be looking at a guy who would fall into that category. Solomon was a guy who started strong but faded. And I'm kind of assuming that we can group ourselves into 1 of 4 groups here. There might be some people here tonight who have never even encountered God. They've never had a personal experience with God. They think of God as this distant being who, you know, maybe he's mad at me. I don't know what he thinks about me. So these would be people who really they don't have a relationship with God. There might be other people who've just started their relationship with God, and maybe you're really excited about it. And that's cool. There might be people who've been walking with God for 10, 20, 30 years, and you're still going strong, and that is awesome, because you're definitely in the minority. But there might be some of us here tonight who at one point were excited about the things of God, but, you know, anymore, we can't really remember what the big deal was. We've gone off and pursued other things. We might even be ashamed of that fact. But why don't you think through, which group would I be in as we study the life of Solomon? Ultimately, what we hope to see is this truth right here, that God is true to his word in reward and in punishment. That's a kind of a sobering lesson that we learn from the life of Solomon. First, a little background, though. Who was this Solomon guy? Well, as you may have guessed from the subtitle, Solomon was a king. Solomon was the third and final king of Israel. And he ruled from around 970 to about 931 BC. He ruled 40 years. Solomon also, he was the son of King David. And this actually has a pretty big impact on his life, this fact right here. The fact that David was his father. Now David, this guy is one of the most famous Jews ever to have lived. He is considered a very godly, holy man, a man who was fully devoted to God, a man after God's own heart. And at one point in David's life, he came to God and he said, God, you know, I've got this house. I've got this really nice house. I've got it good, and you've blessed me with this. I'd like to build a house for you. I'd like to build a place for you that you can call your own, that people can come and worship you. And God was so moved by David's request that he made a promise to David. And theologians refer to this as the Davidic covenant. And what he said to David is, he says, it says, this is what the Lord Almighty says, I will make your name great. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. So he promises David an eternal throne, an eternal kingdom, a great name. But he also promises David something else. He says, when your days are over and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, who will come from your own body, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So this is talking about David's son, Solomon in this case. And he says, actually, your son is the one who's going to build the house for me. And he also says this. He says, I will be his father, and he will be my son. So God is going to set up a special father-son relationship with David's descendants. He's going to look out for these guys. And of course, like any loving father, when he does wrong, I will punish him with the rod of men, with floggings inflicted by men. Now, hopefully, good fathers don't flog their sons. But the point here is that God is going to bring correcting love into David's son's life when he does wrong. But like any good dad, he says, my love will never be taken away from him. Okay? So God has set up this special relationship with David and with David's descendants. This is huge. You can't read the rest of the Bible without having references back to this covenant. Throughout the rest of the Old Testament and even on into the New, the authors of the Bible are pointing back to how God fulfilled this promise. The other thing, then, that we need to keep in mind is David's final charge to Solomon. This is found in 1 Kings 2. Now here David is on his deathbed. We all know that people say very profound things on their deathbed. So this would have been kind of what he's using his last breath to say. And what he says to his son Solomon is, he says, keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, his testimonies, according to what is written in the law of Moses. Notice he says that seven different ways to follow God's law. He says this is crucial. That you may succeed in all that you do, wherever you turn, so that the Lord may carry out the promise which he spoke concerning me. And he points back to that promise that God made to him. So he's saying, Solomon, if there's anything that you remember in your life, remember the centrality of God's law and God's commandments, of God's truth in your life. You've got to remember this. This is crucial. So with that background in mind, we're going to look, first of all, at Solomon's great start. Remember we said he got off to a great start here. Had a great upbringing, and it seemed like at first he had really bought into this idea here. In 1 Kings chapter 3, we see that Solomon goes to God and he offers up 1,000 sacrifices to him in this momentous expression of gratitude and thanksgiving. And so what God does is he comes to Solomon and he says in 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 5, in Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night, and God said, ask me what you wish me to give you. So we've got a blank check from God. God says, you can have anything you want, Solomon. You know, as a kid, I always wanted to have some sort of, like, superpowers or something. I probably would ask for, like, the ability to fly or heat vision. You know, the ability to levitate objects, like in Star Wars. And I wonder why I haven't gotten these blank checks from God. But what Solomon says here is he doesn't even start by asking God for anything. He starts out just by recounting what God has done. He says, you have shown great loving kindness to your servant David, my father, according as he walked before you in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart towards you. You've reserved for him this great loving kindness that you've given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. Now, O Lord my God, you've made your servant king in place of my father David, yet I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or to come in. Your servant is in the midst of this people who you have chosen, a great people too many to be numbered or counted. So give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? And so Solomon, he doesn't ask for riches, wealth, superpowers. Well, that's kind of a superpower. But what he asks for here is he asks for wisdom. He says, I want to be a good king. I want to judge fairly. And this would have been an amazing request in this day. You know, in a day when political authority was an opportunity and just, it was used just to maximize oneself. You'd use your power, you'd use your army to squeeze every last drop out of the people. And instead, he's saying, no, actually, I want to be a good king. I want to be a fair king. So how does God respond? Well, it says it was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. God said to him, because you've asked for this thing and have not asked for yourself long life, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor have you asked for the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself discernment to understand justice. Behold, I've done according to your words. Behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there has been no one like you before you, nor shall one like you arise after you. I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there will not be any among the kings like you all your days. And if you walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and commandments, there's that theme again, as your father David walked, then I will prolong your days. Then Solomon awoke, and behold, it was a dream. And he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and offered burnt offerings and made peace offerings and made a feast for all his servants. So again, Solomon goes and offers up a great sacrifice to God and throws a party, a feast for all of his servants to celebrate how good God is. That's a pretty good start here. That is awesome. So why is this passage here? We need to remember when we're approaching the Bible, this is not just history for history's sake. This is theological narrative. No, it's historical facts assembled to tell us something about God. It's nice to learn things about Solomon, but ultimately the Bible is about God and how he interacts with the different characters throughout time and space. So what does this passage teach about God? Good question. What does this passage teach about God? Well, if you look through here, you'll notice some common themes. You'll see the word give appear 4, 5, 6 times, or some form of that. And in each case, it's God giving. He starts out by asking, ask me what you wish me to give you. And so I think the point is obvious here. We see that God is a giving God, plain and simple. Let's look at who God gives things to and what he gives them in this passage. It's just all over the place. First of all, to Solomon. First of all, Solomon says, you've made me king. Then God gives him a wise and discerning heart more than anyone before or after him. So he makes him the wisest man ever. He gives him riches and honor more than all the kings to follow. And now I know he was the final king of Israel, of the United Kingdom, but it actually split into two parts after Solomon's reign, and Solomon was far richer than any of those kings that would follow. And also he gives him another promise. He promises to prolong his days. Now this one's conditional. This one is conditional upon him obeying God. But the rest of these are unconditional. Unconditional promises from a giving God. He also gives stuff to David here. He says, you have shown great loving kindness to your servant David. And again, later in the passage, he says, you have reserved for him this great loving kindness. He also says, you've given him a son to sit on the throne. Look at all these things you gave to my father. But he doesn't just stop there. He goes on to God's gifts to Israel, to this nation. He says, you chose us as your people, a great people you have chosen. And he says, there are great people which are too many to be numbered or counted. And this is almost definitely a reference to another promise God made hundreds of years beforehand, where he went to Abraham. And he said, Abraham, I'm going to make you a great nation. And Abraham says, you know, God, I'm flattered. That's nice that you're telling me that, but I'm 75 years old. My wife is 65. Things just don't work that way. And God says, why don't you come outside? And it was a real starry night, real clear sky. He says, why don't you look up at the stars? Abraham's like, okay. God says, why don't you tell me how many stars there are out there? And Abraham's like, I can't do that. There's too many to be counted. And God says, so will your descendants be. And later he says, they're going to be more numerous than the sand on the seashore. And Solomon's saying, God, you accomplished your promise. You did it. You've given this to us, not because we deserved it, but just because of who you are. And so God is a generous God. And this whole business about God's generosity, this is nothing new. I mean, this is from cover to cover in the Bible. God is giving to unworthy men and women like us here. I think he says it real well in Ephesians 2, verses 8 and 9, where he says, "For by grace," or by God's charity, "you've been saved." It's not of yourselves. It's not like you were special. It's not like there was something special about you where God said, "Well, gee, you know, this person's so special and so worthy, I'm going to give him something." He says, it is the gift of God, not as a result of works. It's not that it was something you did. It's not like you can do enough to gain God's good gifts. We're totally unworthy of them. He says, and why does he do this? So that no one may boast. That is how God gives his gifts. God gives gifts in such a way that only he can be glorified by them. If you think about it, if he gave gifts to people who are worthy, he really wouldn't be that generous. He'd just be fair. When I go down to pick up my paycheck every month, it's not like I say, "Oh, wow, OSU, they're so generous. They're so good and benevolent. They've given me this large paycheck." No, it's a contract. We had a deal. I did some stuff. They rewarded me for my work. But if one of you were to walk up tonight and hand me a check, you can make this payable to Scott Risley, that's R-I-S-L-E-Y. If one of you were to walk up and hand me a check, that would be a completely generous gift. I wouldn't be able to say that I deserve that. It would be out of nowhere. And I'd probably be kind of blown away that you would just give me money like that. And this is how God gives his gifts. He gives his gifts in such a way that nobody can boast. So what kind of response should this produce in ourselves? How should we respond to this? Well, I think there's really only one response. Humility. Humility. If we really understood how generous this God is, we would have no room for our arrogance, no room for our pride. So that no one can boast, it says. Do you really understand how unworthy you are of God's gifts? Solomon sure did. Let's look at Solomon's humility in this passage. Now, first of all, he acknowledges his inadequacy. He says, "I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or to come in." How different this is when we refuse to admit we're wrong. We refuse to say that we even have a problem. And we stubbornly keep up this facade, pretending like we've got it all together, when inside we're falling apart. We refuse to acknowledge our inadequacy because we're insecure. We don't understand who God is. We don't understand that if we acknowledge our inadequacy, he wants to give to us. But he can't give to us if we won't admit our need. But it's not enough just to admit our need. You know, there's some people who will, you know, they'll sit around all day long and admit all the problems that they have, how inadequate they are. Solomon goes a step further into true humility, and he asks for help. He says, "Give your servant an understanding heart." And again, how different this is. We just refuse to ask for help. We refuse to turn to God and ask him for the help that only he can give us, the charity that only he can give us, that we desperately need. This is a mark of true humility. You know, I'm sure we've all got a friend or a relative or something who just refuses to accept anything from anybody else. You know, you try and pay for dinner and they refuse. You try and give them something like, "Oh no, I can't take that." We don't think that's humility. We're not fooled by that. And it's the same way with God. When we'll admit wrong but we won't ask for help, that's not humility at all. That's just pride. Also, Solomon seeks to serve God here. He says, "You have made your servant king." He says, "Give your servant an understanding heart." So he's seeking God's glory. And this is, again, so different from how we try and seek our own glory. You know, I heard this parable a couple years ago that Christ tells in Luke 14. And he says, when you're invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for someone more distinguished than you may have been invited by him. And he who invited you both will say to you, give your place to this man. And in disgrace, you proceed to occupy the last place. But when you are invited, go and recline at the last place, so that when the one who has invited you comes, he may say to you, friend, move up higher. Then you will have honor in the sight of all who are at the table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and everyone who humbles himself will be exalted. Everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. God cannot exalt you if you're so busy trying to exalt yourself, because then you'll get all the glory for it. What God says is you need to take the low seat, and he will raise you up when the time is right. And I remember I heard this parable, and I thought, you know, I'm that guy. I'm that guy who has taken the top seat at the table, who's positioning to make himself look good, who's insulting other people to make myself feel better about myself, who's complaining because somebody else is in my seat, so obsessed with trying to glorify myself. And I just had to turn to God and say, Lord, make me like that guy who lets you exalt him. And finally here, and this is key, Solomon credits God for past success and expresses gratitude. And look at this. He says, you have shown great loving kindness to your servant David. You have given him a son to sit on his throne. You have made your servant king in place of my father David. Your servant is in the midst of your people who you have chosen. He didn't try and take credit for where he was at. He didn't think to himself, you know, I must be pretty special. I'm king of Israel. I'm in this great people. This must be because of me. He says, no. The only reason I'm here is because of you, God. I don't deserve this. You're the one that's done all this. And our ingratitude completely cuts us off from really seeing how good God is. You know, just today I was reflecting on my life and I realized, you know, there's never been a point in my life when I've not been surrounded with people who have shown me God's love. Multiple people since I was born. That's so cool. And that's something I would not have realized if I hadn't stopped just to take some time and think, what does God bless me with? How good really is God? You cut yourself off from seeing his blessings when you don't just sit and think about him and thank him for it. And it's a mark of true humility. It's our pride that causes this bitterness that says, why am I not getting what I deserve? You know, God, what is it? You make me put up with this crap. What is this stuff you've put in my life? I deserve better. It's the antithesis of what we're talking about here. And all of these things, all of these elements of Solomon's prayer to God, they reflect a deep reverence for God, a deep respect for God. Seems like there's an element of mistrust of himself, an eagerness to follow God. And these are what he calls in some of the other books that he wrote in the Old Testament, the fear of the Lord. Solomon wrote a few other books, and in two of them, Ecclesiastes and Proverbs, this concept of the fear of the Lord comes up multiple times. And it's not fear like, you know, a child would fear his abusive father. You know, fear of hurting him or lashing out in anger at him. It's fear, it's a reverence, it's a deep respect. It's a mistrust of oneself. It's an eagerness to follow God. And he says in Proverbs, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. It's the beginning of knowledge. It's crucial that we can cultivate this fear of the Lord if we ever seek to really tap into God's generosity. So it's a good start. It's a great start. Solomon is doing real well at this point. So where does he go wrong? Where does he go wrong? Well, let's look at Solomon's compromise. And now before we can look at his compromise, there's a little bit more background we need to know. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, what we have here is this is a speech that Moses gave 500 years before Solomon's time. But what he says is, you don't have a king now, but I know that when you ask me for a king, I know at some point you're going to ask for a king. And he says, when you ask for a king, these are my rules for that king. He says, when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me, You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your countrymen you shall set as king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. So apparently he's got to be an Israelite. Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return again that way. He shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. So these are God's instructions of what the king should not do. Pretty simple, three things. First of all, he says, the king should not multiply horses. Okay, so what's wrong with horses? You know, everybody loves horses. I never had a pony as a kid, but that would be kind of cool. He should not multiply horses. Now, it's not wrong to own a horse. But back in this day, horses were a sign of military strength. If you had horses and chariots, you could just run right over all of the nations around you. They were a sign of security. And God is saying, don't take your security from horses. Don't trust in your chariots. Trust in me. I will protect you. Also, it says he shall not multiply wives for himself. Okay, so what is he talking about here? You know, there might be some sort of a component of hedonism. You know, he doesn't want him just shacking up in the bedroom with his wives all the time. But I think it's more than that. I think it's actually the same issue. Marriages were ways to make alliances with other nations. Again, if Solomon's married to the daughter of the king of Moab, he's not going to attack Israel. They're going to have peace. So if you can multiply wives to the point where you've got treaties with all of the powerful nations and families around you, you're home free. You don't need God at all. You're totally secure. Also, it says he shall not greatly increase silver and gold for himself. So, I mean, this is, money is just power in liquid form, okay? Money is just, it represents security. You can protect yourself if you have money. You can hire soldiers. You can pay people off. You can build fortifications. And he's saying, the king cannot try to put security. He can't put his stock in these things that he can amass for himself. But what he should do is this. First of all, it says, it shall come about when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of the law on a scroll. He says, I want you to get out your pen and parchment, and I want you to hand copy the whole law for yourself. Make your own personal copy. Apparently, this was worth the time, in God's opinion, because this his law was so crucial in the lives of the Israelites and especially in the life of the king. And not just make your own personal copy of the law, but then read it all the days of his life and carefully follow it. So you should make your own personal copy of the law. Why? Well, first of all, that he may learn to fear the Lord. There's that concept again, the fear of the Lord. He says, you need to do this if you want to cultivate this reverence for me. It says that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen. You know, if I was king, I would look out and see people are coming to me on a regular basis. They bow to me. They bring me things. They tell me how great I am. You know, Solomon was a powerful king. It would be really easy for him to start thinking, I'm better than these people. I'm worthy of this. I deserve this. Without this anchor of God's truth in his life, he's going to forget about this. It's not going to take more than a couple years for him to be the most arrogant man in the Middle East. You know, these kings, they would call themselves deities. They thought they were gods. They were that detached from reality. Also, that he may not turn aside from the commandment. You know, if I came to you as the king, you've been king for 10 years, you never looked at the law, and I say, you know, the key here to our success as a nation is, first of all, you need to get rid of all these horses and chariots. Second of all, you need to stop trying to multiply, to make these marriages, to make treaties with these nations around. Thirdly, all this money you've got, just give it to God, stick it in the temple or something, and then we'll be secure, because God will protect us. I would think that you were insane if you came and told me that. There's no way that I would continue to follow God, just without continually meditating on it, continually seeing, what has God done? What does God want me to do? And also, says, so that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom. So your obedience will have a direct impact on the prosperity of your kids. So this is, you know, this is the only passage directly written to kings. So you'd think Solomon would at least have this one down as king. So what we have here, this is not the New York Stock Exchange over the past 2 years. What we have here is a spiritual line graph of Solomon's life. And you can think of the point on the far left as, here's Solomon, 1 Kings 3, top of his game. And actually, later in this chapter, we see Solomon levels this really wise decision. And people are just, everywhere in Israel, they just say, wow, God is so awesome to have given this wisdom to men. So God is glorified by Solomon here. But we see in chapter 4, it's telling about the stuff that Solomon has. And we see this suspicious verse slipped in. It says, Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. It doesn't make any comment on it, but the discerning reader will think, wait a minute, that looks familiar. I've seen that somewhere before. He's not supposed to be doing that. But it doesn't say anything about it. It just moves right along. We see, you know, Solomon starts building this temple for God. He sends an order for wood up to the king to the north of him. And the king says, yeah, I'll fulfill your request and praise God because he's put such a wise man on the throne in Israel. So again, God is glorified. That's cool. But in 1 Kings chapter 6 and 7, it says the house or the temple was finished throughout all its parts and according to all its plans. So he was 7 years in building it. Now Solomon was building his own house 13 years and he finished all his house. And again, it doesn't really say anything bad about Solomon, but you wonder why these two verses are right next to each other. You wonder if Solomon's heart is beginning to shift, if there's this gradual decline, his priorities are changing. But he prays this amazing prayer to dedicate the temple. He says, I want this to be a place where people from all the nations can come and worship you, God. But chapter 9 says, Hiram sent to the king 120 talents of gold. Now, what's a talent of gold? Well, a talent was actually a unit of measurement of weight. And a talent, we know, was about 90 pounds. So in today's standards, as of last week, gold was, I think, $325 an ounce. So 325 times 16 times 90 is close to a half a million. So one talent of gold is worth close to a half a million. And it says that Hiram sent 120 of these to Solomon. Now, I don't know what it means to multiply gold and silver, but it seems like he's pushing the line here. And again, later this chapter, he says they went to Ophir, this is a place to the south, and took 420 talents of gold from there and brought it to Solomon. So that's another 200 million, approximately. Again, multiplying gold and silver. Direct violation. You can almost see the author, the prophet historian that wrote this book. It's like he's got a copy of Deuteronomy open here, and he's got his pen and paper here. And he's like, oh, he didn't do that. He didn't do that. It's like he's directly just cutting and pasting. We see Solomon, the queen of Sheba, comes and is amazed by his wisdom, which is good. Glorifies God, but then it says she gave the king 120 talents of gold and a very great amount of spices and precious stones. Never again did such an abundance of spices come in as that which the queen of Sheba gave King Solomon. And so another 120 talents of gold plus a bunch of spices. And this was not like, you know, a ship full of black pepper that rolled into the ports. These spices were worth a lot of money back then. And it says this was a historic load of spices. Never again did so much spices, so much spice roll into Israel. And you see a summary here. chapter 10, it spends 8 or 9 verses talking about all the stuff that Solomon did with his gold and silver. It says that in his day, silver wasn't even worth anything because it was so abundant. It was like gravel. That's how much he had. It says that he just was plating everything with gold. He was running out of things to plate with gold. He's making all of his cups out of gold. It also says that he multiplied horses. Hundreds of chariots, thousands of horsemen and stalls. And he had these chariot cities set up throughout the nation where he would store these at. And also we see that he multiplied wives. It says that he had 700 wives. That's 700. And 300 concubines. That's 1,000 women. I mean, come on. That's like one woman per day for 3 years. I think you'd have trouble keeping all the names straight. And you are... Right, that's right. I would say that's multiplying wives. And the result? Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. Half-hearted devotion to God. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely, as David's father, his father had done. So Solomon has gone from this incredible start to this point in his life, where it says he did evil in the eyes of the Lord. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. Worship of Molech involved child sacrifice. And this is on a hill east of Jerusalem. So he's standing out there with his foreign wives while the priest offers up this infant into the fire, into the red-hot arms of this god. How could he fall so far? It's a good question. How could Solomon fall so far? And I think it's a warning that we all should take heed from. But ultimately, again, we're not here to learn just about Solomon. We're here to learn about God. And how does God respond to Solomon? Well, it says in 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 9 and following. It says, "Now the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing." He'd gone to Solomon and warned him twice, personally, that he should not go after other gods. But he did not observe what the Lord had commanded. So the Lord said to Solomon, "Because you have done this, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen." So what do we learn about God here? We learn that God has integrity. That God is true to his word. If God says something is going to happen, you can guarantee that that is going to happen. Let's look at how God was true to his word. Well, he will still punish Solomon, just like he'd warned him, unfortunately. He raised up foreign adversaries. It says that he raised up one on the kind of the southeast border and one on the northern border. Verses 14 and 23 of this chapter. He took away the northern 10 tribes. He sends a prophet to Jeroboam and says, "You're going to rule most of this kingdom after Solomon dies." Here's another one. It says that he suffered the pains of regret and addiction. You see, Solomon apparently had a change of heart way at the end of his life where he realized he'd gone astray. And he wrote the book of Ecclesiastes at that point. Most scholars believe it was written by him. And here's what he writes there. He says, "I said to myself," and this, he's looking back at this period of rebellion in his life. He says, "Come now, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself. And behold, it too was futility. I said of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I explored my mind, how to stimulate my body with wine. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I had all this stuff. I bought male and female slaves, and I had homeborn slaves. I had this whole army of slaves, and we're breeding more slaves. Limitless workforce. I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. That's an understatement. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. Now this is the American dream. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them? What more could we ask? Our society is built around that principle. And was Solomon happy? Not at all. He says, at the end of his life, thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity, superficial worthlessness, and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. And I like that, that metaphor, striving after the wind, because in its very nature, you can't catch it. And when you're pursuing fulfillment this way that Solomon pursued it, apart from God's plan, this is the experience that you're going to have. And you can see Solomon at the end of his life just saying, meaningless. What have I done? I wasted so many years. Foolish. Caused him to be known as a man who started strong but drifted away. But we also see about God is that he will still keep his promises to David. And this is the part that blows my mind. I can understand. Yeah, you didn't do what I said. Now I'm going to punish you. But the fact that God is still going to bless Solomon and David, it's like he's bending over backward to do this. First of all, he still kept the man from David's line on the throne in Judah. And he let Solomon finish his reign. Also, God eventually brought the Messiah out of David and Solomon's line, just like he promised he would. It says that he allowed Solomon to build the temple, just like he promised. And he gave Solomon riches and wisdom that are still remembered today, just like he promised. God is so faithful. We can trust in the things that God says. I think this is crucial for us to understand this. If we're ever going to truly follow God, we've got to be able to trust him. Got to trust that he's out for our good, just like he's promised that he is. So God has integrity 100% of the time. And we also learn about God's sovereignty. When God talks about these things that he's going to do, it's not like, I'm going to muster up all this strength and I'm going to do this. I'm going to take the kingdom away from you if I can win the battle. No, not at all. He says, this is what I'm going to do. Early in Solomon's life, he says, I'm going to make you the wisest man that ever lived. I'm going to give you immense wealth. I'm going to bless you. And it's completely simple for God. It's just, if he wills it, he can do it. You know, I think about if I were to write a letter to the United States government, and I said, dear members of the House and the Senate, hi, my name is Scott. Enclosed, I have a list of my commandments, my statutes, my ordinances. If you follow these, your nation will prosper. If you do not, then I will destroy you. I will bring other nations in to wipe you out. What would they do if they got a letter like that? Well, they'd probably arrest me, yes. but it's silly because I don't have the power to accomplish that. Even if I totally intend to do it, I don't have the power to accomplish that. But with God, he has the power to accomplish these things. So application for them. Application for Israel. Believe God's word and cling to it. The Bible is clear that the biggest threat to Israel's national security was not how big the nations were around them, not how strong they were. It was whether or not the nation was faithful to God. And the point here is, be faithful to God. What about the application for us? You know, God has not made the same promises to us as he made to Israel. You know, he didn't say that, you know, if we rebel against him, he's going to bring Canada down in to invade us and to take away this great nation as they roll through Montana. But he has made a number of promises to us as individuals. And the application, I would say, would be very similar. We need to believe God's word and cling to it. We need to trust the things that God has said are true. We need to trust that the way God has planned us to live our lives is going to be good and fulfilling. And we need to follow him with that. We need to pray that God would put people in our lives that would redirect us when we're getting off base, that would encourage us when we're losing strength and we want to give up. We need to respond the right way when these people come and talk to us about these things. We need to not let a day pass that we're not meditating on God's word and on God's truth, because otherwise we're going to become just as deceived and insane as Solomon was. We're going to have no reference point, no anchor for our perspective. So, some conclusions here. What we've seen is that God is a giving God. God is so giving. I hope that you'll turn to God and receive his generosity, because God wants to give you salvation. If you turn to God, you admit your need, you admit that you're not cutting it on your own, that you need him in your life, and ask him, he will help. He will revolutionize your life in a positive way that you will never regret. We also learn that God is sovereign and he will be true to his word. He will give us the freedom to rebel against him, but he also will say, this is what it's going to turn out like. And so the only option I can see is we need to choose to follow him. We need to choose to follow him now. If you're in that group of people that has never even come to God in the first place and begun a relationship, do it now. Don't let another day go by. If you're in that group of people that has only recently come to know God and is still real excited about him, commit yourself to his word. It's going to be your lifeline. God says in Deuteronomy 32:47 that this is not just an idle word for you. It is your life. If you're one of those people that has been following God for years, keep heading in that same direction. Don't let up. Help other people to understand the things that God has said. Help other people to understand his perspective. Be a spokesman. And finally, if you're in that group of people that maybe was excited about God at one point and find yourself in a state of compromise, there's hope. Begin today to follow God again. To admit to him where you're at and say, what is the next step that I can take? Maybe ask the person you came with. I like the conclusion that Solomon comes to. At the end of Ecclesiastes, this is the end of his life. And this is the wisest man who ever lived. So he says the conclusion, when all has been heard, is this: fear God and keep his commandments. Because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. Now I know this sounds like a negative way to end here, but really it's not. Because what this is saying is, we can know that we're not going to end up in a compromised state. We can know that we're not going to end up failing. We can know that when we look back 30 years from now, we can be pleased with how our lives turned out. Because God is going to be true to his word to reward you if you follow him. So, that is Solomon. Why don't we take a couple minutes here and pray? And, Lord, it's kind of embarrassing to come to you sometimes and see how much you've blessed us, but at the same time, it's also very, I guess it's just very refreshing, God, to see you and how good you are in contrast to how rotten a lot of things around us are. I pray that we would all really cling to your truth, God, that we would seek out your perspective and be a little distrustful of our own, Lord. And I'm just grateful that we can trust you, Lord. Amen.